Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software, or are interested in finding a great place to work, do check out their links in the description below. My guest today has done work of such importance that I think that it changes how we think about and approach software development for the better globally. The people who build better software faster know how to do this and understand better what works and what doesn't because of her work. She's a DevOps developer, productivity expert who thrives on helping large organizations to reshape their culture, process, and technology to improve their businesses and enhance the developer experience. Or as she puts it, she uses research, strategy, data, and collaboration to make things awesome. She was the moving force behind the State of DevOps research. She founded the Dora, now part of Google, and she currently works as a partner at Microsoft Research. She's also co-author of what I think is the most important book on software published in the last 10 years, Accelerate, the Science of Lean Software and DevOps. As an aside, we also share a co-author in Jess Humble. Please welcome my guest for today, Dr. Nicole Forsgren. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for agreeing to take part. I know you don't do lots of these kinds of interviews these days. You're too famous.
Maybe just busy, but it's always so good.
Maybe
to see
just
you.
Busy. Maybe both. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's a delight to talk to you. We've met a few times for short periods, but you've been so influential, certainly in my corner of the software development world. Everybody that I know talks about your work and is grateful for it. It helps us to better understand what we're doing. I remember I was a long believer in Martin Fowler's statement that you know, you can't really measure software development until your work came along, and now on the opposite, I think you can. I know that you have a strong scientific background. I'm a science hobbyist. So in the title of the book, Accelerate, it says the science of lean and lean software and DevOps. Could you explain a little bit, you know, some of that science and why that matters?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you so much for the kind words. I really appreciate, you know, the industry reception in particular, because I think that one of the things that is most important for me personally about research is how we can really apply it in practice. And I'm also sure that for every person that loves Dora and loves the Accelerate work, there are also many people that swear at it quite often. So we'll talk about some of that here. So what makes the science? You know, I think that comes down to a handful of things, right? It comes down to having, in essence, a testable hypothesis. But that is like a nice grand statement. And I will say, like, one of my pet peeves is someone to be like, well, my hypothesis is this. And I'm like, that's not the right use of that word. You can't test that. That's not a thing. I appreciate folks who are at least trying to bring structure to the work that they do. Side of any rant. But the work that we wanted to do was find a way to see if, you know, kind of the TLDR, does the way we build software matter? Does it at all? And the challenge was that, like, back in the day, there was no evidence, and I'm sure people have, like, heard me say this before, there was no evidence that making investments in software had ROI on the bottom line, because that was the only way people could think of operationalizing it. Okay, operationalize is just a word to say, like, how do you turn an idea into a measure and then, like, kind of test that, right? Or operationalize is like turn an idea into a metric, right? And then could you test that hypothesis? And so they were like, money into tech equals money on a financial statement. And that doesn't work. And so, you know, we were chatting, right? It was like me and Jez and Jean and, like, Alana and Nigel and everyone were like, well, but it's because it doesn't just turn into this magic. It's because you have to have investments, yes, but into a bunch of technological things which help you. Like, how do you get this money? You do a bunch of tech, you're building software better. That software features, you know, many times we say features, but like, even if you're in a not-for-profit, but you're doing something, and that is what gives you your organizational performance. Okay, so you've heard me kind of, now that I've broken that down, I like seeing things in pictures, right? So I immediately am like running to a whiteboard and I'm putting like, okay, boxes. So I'm like, we have tech, we have process, we have probably the culture, like we have things into better software, like software features, right? So I'm able to, and like at that point, we're still kind of, it's still kind of fuzzy, but I'm like, I can get a feature to a customer or to a person or to a user, and then I get money or better customer service, right? Better customer outcomes. And we're like, okay, this is making more sense because it's not just dollars in, dollars out. How am I going to measure this, right? How am I going to operationalize this? The challenge, you know, everyone jump in your Wayback Machine with me. This was the end of, this was like late 2013. For anyone who's doing this work now, you know that getting many of these measures out of our complex end-to-end software development systems is incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult because you need to somehow go from writing code, like pulling code, writing code, characteristics of your systems, all the way into production. Assuming you have all of that, it may take you years to get there. Okay, 10 years ago, plus 10 plus years ago, this was not a thing, right? This did not exist. And I think that's where many people would stop. They would either stop or they would go back to dollars in, just straight dollars in, dollars out. And I was like, okay, well, we need to find another way to proxy this information. And so that's where we started thinking about, okay, let's use survey measures, but not just any survey measure, very rigorous psychometric methods, right? And by that, it's asking fairly precise questions about, now if we have a concept, let's ask several questions about it so that we can kind of get to that idea. You can ask several aspects of the question and then run a bunch of statistical tests to make sure that everyone's kind of reading it the same way. It's the statistical version of like a card sorting task. If I were to write many questions on 3x5 cards and hand them out to people, do they put them in the same piles, basically? And then if it's all in the same pile, that's version control, or that's continuous integration, or that's loosely coupled architecture or something. And that's important for several reasons. One, because then I have a pretty good idea that I'm capturing the same thing, even if people are answering differently.
Yeah.
You know, high, medium, low, I'm doing well, we're not doing well. Also because people use different words to mean different things. Maybe they're calling it continuous integration, maybe they're not. You know, sometimes we were working with companies and they were talking about, what do you mean continuous integration is something I'm struggling with? We just had a big initiative last year on continuous integration. Now we're doing it well. Turns out they had, due to strategic or investment or resourcing decisions, they had decided continuous integration only had one thing. It didn't have the two or three pieces that are important to have good CI, right? You need the technology components. You need the behavioral components where you prioritize keeping a build green, right? Yeah. It's not just tech. It's also people.
Yeah.
So when I think about the science there, it is having a good theoretical conceptualization. Now I'm noticing I'm starting there. It's having a way to operationalize that we know is robust and valid and reliable and rigorous. And then it is testing with good statistical measures. Now I go in that order. We don't just grab data and then check to see what works. Now, sometimes we do, right? Sometimes we're in a world where we're like, I need to make a business decision at some point. And like making a decision based on data is often better than making a decision based on who knows, right? The wind. So a correlation can be good, but if I want to do something that's based on prediction, we have a few options. You can do strict prediction, which you need to have lots of historical data. We didn't have this in this case, right? We were doing a cross-sectional data set at one point in time. So then we could do inferential prediction. And that is where we start with a theoretical model and a theoretical idea of what things should look like. And then we apply prediction methods to that model. And if it holds, we have greater confidence that that's what's happening. And this is what is used in several disciplines. So
that's one of the things that I always find, I think I and others maybe find a little confusing. So my interest in science and a very limited degree, my background in science is more on the hard sciences, physics, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it seems to me that software development as a profession is one of those things that applies to people with that kind of mindset, that kind of background. I think people with a mathematical turn of mind tend to enjoy working with software. And so I think often people with that kind of background are looking for too precise an answer. And this isn't that kind of science. It's more in line with kind of sociology. We're studying human behaviors and the impact of those to some degree, it seems to me. Would you agree with that? And that means that it's a little fuzzier around the edges. It's a little bit more statistical and so on. And so not less rigorous, though.
It's so I'll just say yes and
a different
no.
Kind. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll say yes and no. Like, I love how you point out that, like, many folks that are in computer science and data science and in this field and engineering, we come up with certain types of mathematical training that appear, that feel very rigorous. And they appear very black and white, right? And so when you show someone, or when you say, I'm going to measure something with a survey question, you immediately say, oh, well, this is not, you know, I'm a researcher, I'm going to use the words, that's not valid, that's not reliable.
Yeah.
Normal people are going to say, well, people lie. I can't use this. I can't rely on this. I can rely on data that comes from a system. This is reliable. I know where this comes from. And I'm like, well, but do you? What's the definition for that data point? How reliable is that metric? What's the precise start and end point for that metric? How consistent is that across teams, systems, organizations? How consistent is the naming? How consistent is the collection? How consistent is the normalization? How consistent is, and suddenly something that looks incredibly precise in an objective measure, the data point that comes out of a system, gets very, very fuzzy when it looked like it was incredibly concrete.
And then everything ends up being statistical in the end because of quantum physics.
Right? Yeah. And so then you'll come to a survey question and you're like, well, that's just I could never trust that. And I'm like, a lot of times you're right. You can't, right? Because like, it's just a question.
Yeah.
But just like there are ways to make objective data better, there are ways to make subjective data better. So subjective data is the data that comes from people. And I also want to point out that there are many things that we cannot get from systems. Some things we can only get from people. So, you know, the example I gave was CI. CI is a technological thing, right? Do we have our systems automated correctly? But there's also a very strong behavioral component. You can have something totally automated, but the team doesn't care that the build stays green and they just let it break and they keep moving.
Yeah.
You do not have CI. You do not have continuous integration because it is not continuously integrating if your build is broken.
Yeah.
And so there are certain things that we necessarily need to ask people about. And there are some things that are more helpful or useful or fast to ask people about, right? Again, way back, not even way back machine, today. If we're trying to fully instrument an end-to-end system, it'll usually take you at least 2 years. And that's being super optimistic, 2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
I can send out a very well-designed research instrument where we word the questions very specifically, right? And we could chat about some of those. I could chat about that all day if you ever want, right? But like, how do you time box it? How do you frame it? How do you phrase it? What do you think about the options?
Yeah.
And I can get data back in, let's even say 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes 2 weeks. And I don't have to go through many of the data cleaning and normalization steps. We still do data cleaning and normalization to look for outliers and everything, but I don't have the worry that one team calls this data point one thing and another team calls a data point something else. Are they the same? Or these two teams call a data point the same thing, but they're very, very different things. That can also take months.
Yeah.
So we can come to these conclusions much, much faster about what is happening in our systems. What are the behaviors? What are the processes? How do our systems behave? We can ask people how their systems behave.
Yeah. Indeed. One of my hobby horses these days is trying to take back the term software engineering to really mean engineering, by which I mean in modern engineering terms, the practical application of science. So I know they're not the same thing, but engineering is kind of a scientifically rational, is based on scientifically rational roots, because engineering is the stuff that works. And yeah. Sometimes I get asked, what's the difference then between craft and engineering? Because software as a craft is an appealing idea to many people. And my answer is usually measurement. And I think you've just said that, I think I take what you're saying is the same thing. And you can measure almost anything. It's just some things are harder and some things are easier, but you should still be trying. You should still be attempting to measure things.
You can measure anything poorly and you can measure anything well.
Indeed.
And to measure something very well, it usually takes more effort.
Yeah.
At least up front to set it up.
Even the seemingly easy things to measure are incredibly difficult. I had a background in very low latency systems, and we found that we were measuring things to less than a millisecond accuracy, and that wasn't enough because the curve was the outliers were kind of just at that boundary, and so it all looked okay. But some of them were the long tail was really horrible. The average was fine within a millisecond response time, and the outliers were horrible and were not fit for purpose. So we had to get really complicated with some of the measurement for that stuff to get down to the sorts of measurement that we needed to do. So I think it's a really interesting take.
Yeah. And as like a random joke aside, right? Everyone's like, oh, well, surveys are proxies. They're not real measures. Anything you get out of your system is a proxy, right? It represents something else to someone. I did performance for a long time. I was a performance engineer. Anytime you tell me response time, I immediately hear performance because that's what it represents to me.
Yeah.
Also, anything you get out of your systems can be modified in some way, right? It could be interrupted by an electrical signal. It could be modified by even temperature sometimes. And so the things that we get out of our systems are not always as reliable as we assume.
Indeed. Yeah. So I've made this statement quite a few times, and I'm interested to hear your reaction to it. I think that the Dora work was the first and most scientifically justifiable study of software development practice. I think it's the reason why I think of it as being so important as a piece of work is that it puts our discipline on a more intellectually sound footing. It allows us to reason about the things that we're doing more effectively. Do you see it that way? Is that an overstatement, or do you think that that's a reasonable statement? It seems perfectly reasonable to me.
That at the time, that may have been true, especially if you think about the full. I would say it's true. It was true. I haven't done a deep literature search in the last couple of years, but I think, especially at its time, it was particularly, excuse me, when you look at the full end-to-end software process, right? Although, you know, we primarily focused on code commit, running in production. There has been, and there was like a lot of very fantastic and fairly rigorous work, but it tended to be focused on like small, very focused pieces.
Yes.
Because that, you know, many times that's how you do research, right? No research is perfect. All research designs have pros and cons. We have to think about, you know, limitations and there's trade-offs in research design. But one of the biggest challenges of thinking about software engineering and software engineering as practice is, you know, you and I have had this conversation previously, is that software engineering isn't just writing code or isn't just doing a test or isn't just debugging or isn't just this. It's about getting your software into production or into the hands of users or into a state where it is delivering value for some organization. Yeah. And with that lens, that hadn't really been done before, or it hadn't been done at scale.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we were able to do that and do it year over year and replicate so many of our results, many, many years across so many users, and then share that back, I think I probably agree with.
In more recent versions of the, here's where my scientific, my degree of scientific rigor is sometimes tested, I suppose. But in more recent versions of the DORA findings, it questions some of the things that I believe. So I have to take the data, but I wonder what you thought about some of those findings. So things like I can't remember if it's this year's or last year's report, there was a finding that said that continuous integration was predicted more burnout in teams. That just seems plain wrong to me from my experience and my understanding of previous results.
What
do you think's going on? There's a couple of things like that.
I think there are a couple of things, and I'm not involved in the report right now, so I'm like not familiar with many of the research design and decisions and analyses that happen. But from like an external point of view, there have been a couple of findings that I I don't agree with, and it's not just that I don't agree with, it's that I think I have a question with methodology. So one that comes to mind was that I think it was continuous integration predicts negative organizational outcomes is one example. That just on its face, right? That's an inappropriate analysis. And here's why, right? That to me feels like a spurious correlation. So a spurious correlation are things that happen to move together or apart, right? In this case, a negative correlation. So first of all, I think it's spurious, and I think it's a correlation, not a prediction. Here's why. First of all, it can't be a strict, and I'm using the word strict prediction. The word prediction, depending on the field, tangent, sorry folks, fast forward like 30 seconds probably. Depending on the field that you're in, different disciplines use the word prediction differently. So I try to differentiate the two by saying strict prediction, which requires longitudinal data, and inferential prediction, which can use cross-sectional data, but requires an a priori theoretical reason for that relationship to exist. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it can only be a correlation.
Okay. Yeah.
So based on that, there's no longitudinal data, so it can't be strict prediction. Right. Now, with single point in time data, you have to have a reason, a theoretical existing reason to believe that relationship should exist. There is no reason to believe that CI should go straight to an organization's bottom line. Why? Mm-hmm. Because there's no link. CI helps us deliver software, which can lead to organizational outcomes.
Yeah.
Right. When we think through some of like the DORA reports or the DORA pictures, right? Like I said, I love boxes and arrows, but there is nothing that goes from a CI system to a customer spending money. You have to go through the feature that you deliver or the value that you deliver. There is no way, there is no reason, there's no theory. Like as I go through many, many of the theories that I could think of from a theoretical standpoint, from a literature from an organizational design or organizational theory standpoint, or a value standpoint, that would go from CI straight to org, to org value. And so from that standpoint, like it's basically probably a spurious correlation. There may be a reason for the correlation. In that case, it would probably be like, if I were guessing, right, this would appear in the discussion section of it would either be excluded, right? A reviewer would probably just exclude saying it's probably spurious. If it would appear, it would appear in a discussion section saying it may reflect the complexity of the software or coordination costs on the team or something else. But
And like, I like the answer. That makes an awful lot of sense to me, because that plays to one of the other things that I think is a common problem. We were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, but it's, you know, the way that you pick your metrics. I mean, one of the this is an overused word, but I think that one of the pieces of genius in the State of DevOps report and the Dora metrics was that the metrics that you chose are important, abstract enough to be entirely generic, but really matter to everybody that builds software, whatever the nature. And so,
and they're fairly actionable.
And like and they're
you
actionable.
You can look at each
yeah.
item and you can figure out some type of thing that you can do.
Yeah,
and I try to deliver some type of actionable insight.
So they provide us a tool to steer change and to guide us down a path to doing a better job. And there's not much in software that's like that. That's quite a profound thing to achieve. And I think that's the thing that kind of blew me away when I first came across it, was that, of course, these things measure the quality of our output. The stability measure the quality of our output. The throughput measure the efficiency with which we can deliver software. My tagline for my business and my work is, I often use the phrase, better software faster, because that's what your research says. It says, if you do these things, you build better software faster. And who wants worse software slower? You know, and it's fairly obvious.
Yeah, that's not fun. I do want to say the continuing Dora team, I think, has done really great work. There have been a couple like methodological nits like that, but I think in general, it's been exciting to see the research program continue to
evolve. One of the conversations that I've had with them in the past is the dilemma between reasserting things that you found out years ago, you know, in the earlier versions of the survey and the report, and discovering new things. Because it seems to me, with something that's quite so important as this, there's value in both, and there's a balance to be had. And I'm a bit nervous of so I've had the comment to me from doubters in the past, where people have said, "Yeah, but that was years ago. It's all changed now." I mean, I don't believe that things change that fast. You know, if you look at the problems in software development, Fred Brooks nailed most of them in 1970. So things are not that different. So, but some people think that they are. So where do you stand on the value of doing research as a snapshot in time versus continually monitoring this? Is this the kind of research that we should be keeping up, you know, remeasuring the impact of, you know, still checking that all of the practices of continuous delivery predict better organizational outcomes? Should we keep validating that all of the time, or should we leave that and go and look somewhere else, go and see what the impact of AI is?
This is a great question, right? And there's actually, I think there are several embedded questions in there, right? One is, what is the value to the industry and where's the state of the industry, right? Another question is an embedded research design question. How does that impact the research design and the methodology? Because there are actually... there are things that you need to think about when you design an overall research program and a large predictive model. If you make significant changes, it can actually have some impact on what your calculations look like. And not that it will like suddenly shift everything, but how you run your calculations, how you communicate those calculations can have some impact. And so you want to think about it from a methodological research design standpoint. Some of it is going to be a marketing question, right? Because once you stop measuring something, you lose some people who have, which it touches on the industry piece, but it is a separate marketing communication question, because you lose the ability to have year-over-year comparisons and benchmarks. And so how do you think about that? For whoever is owning that decision right now, I hit that decision many, many times, right? It is, my heart goes out to them. It is not a straightforward decision, right? I had to kind of struggle with that and later times advocate for and articulate my decision or, you know, my stance every year. And there were times that people got very, very upset when I removed one or two items or constructs in order to explore a few others, because we also, like right now, the DORA survey is, I want to say, like when I was running, it was around 20, between 20 and 25 minutes. That is long. You are at the upper limit of people being able to take that survey and like kind of hang in there. We cannot just like forever, the royal we cannot just forever be adding items to surveys so that it's an hour long survey, right? There's only one good survey that I'm aware of that was ever an hour long. It was like the famed Amazon developer survey, which they stopped doing, and it was once a year and it was internal. Like that's a very, very unique special case. Like in general, you cannot cross 20 to 25 minutes. And so you have to be thinking about trades. If you're going to add something, you've got to remove something. But then what does that signal to the industry? What does that mean for marketing? What does that mean for communications? Yeah. What does that mean for messaging? And then what does that implied mean for your holistic picture? Because you can hint at the inclusion of, let's say you remove a bunch of items to do a deep, deep dive on AI, right?
Yeah.
When you do that, you can then speak to the results, but technically from a scientific perspective, you cannot, let's say we rip out all architecture.
Yeah.
From a scientific perspective, you can't talk about the importance of architecture in your current research.
Yeah.
We can say that we found it in the past. And so now you have a new research-based decision to make, which is going to be at odds of the marketing-based research decision to make, which is going to be that this program still likely holds, it probably holds, right? But like technically, strictly speaking, they weren't all fully tested that year. And so you really are dealing with these trade-offs. Now, to your previous question, right, has industry changed? I don't think so, right? Like I will say I don't think so. Now, why? For a few reasons. One, we tested so many of these things for several years, and they held true. Two, I continue to work with many customers and chat with many technology leaders across so many organizations, a few small, most medium and large size, and they struggle with the exact same things, including companies that would surprise you, right? And it's the exact same things that I came across in 2013 and 2014 and 2015. And sometimes they'll say, oh, but I need a brand new benchmark. Oh, but I need the newest research. And I'm like, no, see this right here? And I can even pull out like 2015's report, this and this and this.
Fix these
five things. Look at I'm making some, number two and number four of these like items. It appears that this is what you're struggling with.
Yes.
Oh well, yeah, but I'm like, do you really need to wait 6 months for the latest report to come out when you know that this is what you're struggling with and that these are the answers, right? To your point about something that's generalizable and gives you action items.
Yeah.
You know that this is what you is probably going to give you very, very good results.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 absolutely. And I think that kind of model. So you were saying about things don't change very much, but I think that's, you know, this work has changed the industry, because I've been a professional software developer since the very early 1980s. So for a long time, and in my time, I don't think there's been a time where there's greater consensus amongst the people that are, we'd all think of as experts or, you know, thought leaders in the industry. I don't think there's been a time when there's more consensus than there is now. I think nearly everybody would agree that, you know, you work in small steps, you validate the small steps, you optimize for fast feedback, and all of those kinds of things that you and I would treat as motherhood and apple pie. I think nearly all of the people whose opinions I think are worth listening to would be saying the same things, largely. They might be saying them in different ways. And, you know, there might be nuances on which we disagree, but largely, some people take it more seriously than others, but I don't think there's much doubt about what works. And I think that's a big step forwards. And if you look at nearly all of the organizations that we think of as great at software development, there's some form, for obvious reasons, because this is the stuff that works, but there's some form of this stuff at play in those organizations.
I will say I can look back though, and I can see a time where Waterfall was the only way we knew how to build software. And now this is the way that we have found is currently the best way to build software. I look forward to the time that Dora and Accelerate and the current practices are completely obsolete. And we look back and we're like, how ridiculous is that? What were they thinking, right? Like, there was all this science of some, right? Because we also had a whole bunch of research showing that like Waterfall was good. But that was what we had. And now this is what we have. And I'm super excited to see who is going to come up with the next new idea and then find some good data to say, this is a much better way. It's much faster. It's much more reliable. It's much more resilient. Right? There's going to be a new way.
While we're talking about the science of this, though, one of the books that I found really influential about science is a book called The Beginning of Infinity by David Deutsch at Oxford. And he's talking about the philosophy of science, really, and how we generate new knowledge. And one of the things that he says, I think it was him anyway, but one of the things that I think he said that sort of jokingly is you can tell how well understood an idea is by counting the number of books. Actually, it might have been somebody else. But anyway, if you've got shelves and shelves on, quantum theory, it means that we don't understand it yet. If there's one book that you must read to understand quantum theory, then that's a solved problem. And it seems to me that we're close to there. I have a joke in one of my conference talks, which is that when the AIs do finally take over and they're writing all of the code, they'll still be practicing a version of continuous delivery because you have to move in small steps. You have to work experimentally. You have to do that based on feedback. However brilliant you are, you don't intuit a solution. However genius you are, even if they're millions of times smarter than us, they're going to be at their capacity. If they want to do something that builds things that are at the edges of their capacity, they've still got to be working incrementally and trying stuff out to see what works. And because, you try stuff out, see what works, and keep doing that. It seems fairly fundamental to me.
Yeah.
So I think this is a step change. I think this was a step to infinity in terms of coming up with mechanisms that allow us to just do better stuff. Because none of the stuff that your research shows says that you need to be using functional programming or Clojure or Python or C#. None of that level of stuff matters.
Yeah. We didn't dictate or test specifically on any language, on any technology stack, on any tool chain.
So there's something deeper going on in terms of the way that people solve problems, it seems to me. And particularly
we did try technically to stick to like kind of problems. Capabilities and principles that could be broadly applied. And we do. Right. I mean, there are some things that are going to be trickier to apply, but like in the cloud, right, there's one capability, this cloud-based architecture, and there are five aspects of executing and doing cloud-based architecture well. It comes from NIST. I was super excited because, NIST had guidelines, and so we tested them. It actually held up quite well through all of the statistical tests. But they are architectural guidelines that, let's say you're in a mainframe environment, you can try to implement as many of these architectural guidelines as possible to get you closer to the benefits of being in an external commercial cloud or having, an internal data center. You can, by having these types of capabilities and principles that are built into the research model that are tested like this, where we see the benefits and the outcomes of folks who are kind of operationalized this way and who have systems that are architected and that are actually running this way, I think that's the benefit. And, I will say that's another piece, right? Why we didn't say, are you in the cloud? We actually built in a test with there where, we asked, one of the survey questions, are you in the cloud? And then later we asked each of these five components separately. And we found that, I want to say off the top of my head, it was like a 32 or 33X. You were 32 or 33 times more likely to actually be a high performer if you not only said you were in the cloud, but you had all five of those requirements, like prerequisites for cloud computing. You were doing all five of them versus just like you spent your money somewhere else, right?
Yeah. So we on the Continuous Delivery YouTube channel, we have a Patreon supporters, a group of Patreon supporters, and when we're going to do one of these things, we often ask them to see if they've got any questions. One of the questions that Guy from Patreon asked was, I'll read it out to you. I'd be curious to hear Nicole's thoughts on ways other than presenting data to convince people to try something new. So I know this might not necessarily be your part of the problem because you're the person that's presenting the data, but I think it's a reasonable comment to say that often to win an argument, data's not enough. You and I would both, I think that it's vitally important if we are to remain rational in making those kinds of choices. But what's your experience of just trying to get some of those people, those doubters, those laggers that you, maybe you were talking about before, to listen? Because I think that what we're saying, I mean, sorry, I'm going off on a sidebar now, but you already mentioned this is about much more than just the technicalities. You know, we're talking about improving people's lives because that's what the research says. There's less burnout. Mm-hmm. There's greater work-life, people's perceived work-life balance is improved by adopting these kinds of behaviours for software development. So how do we convince people that, you know, that these things are in their own interest and that they should be taking them more seriously? Do you have any views on that? I'm happy if you want to pass.
It's such a great question. And, you know, unfortunately, the answer here is it depends, right? I too have faced this, so don't worry. It's not just you, the royal you. And I think a lot of it comes down to sitting and listening and getting curious and trying to make sure that you understand the other person's point of view and make sure that they know that they feel heard. And then also, you know, appealing to the things that might resonate with them, right? And then try to understand what some of the blockers or what the resistance might be coming from, right? Is it because there is a lack of resources? Is it because they're just tired because they've tried so many things? Is it because the data is not compelling? Is it because the data isn't compelling? It might be compelling for them, but they know that the data isn't going to be compelling for their boss. Do you need to appeal to a sense of expertise? That doesn't mean like bring me in, right? Like I've been in places where they're like, I don't want to hear from you because you're not like you're an expert over there, but you're not an expert here.
Yeah.
And so then it's kind of like going around and really listening to and trying to surface what are the things that are going to help and going to resonate and what is the problem and what is the felt need? And frankly, like sometimes the thing that you're trying to talk about or trying to share either doesn't solve their problem or they don't have the problem that you think, or they don't feel the problem that you think is there.
Yeah. I often frame my version of, I think, the same advice, which is first have the conversation on their terms, not yours. Don't go and tell people that you want to do continuous integration. Tell people that you want to make sure that we can deliver software faster and more safely into the hands of users. What matters to the people is what really matters, and different people will frame the problem differently. And the other thing, if you want to win friends and influence people, is try and identify a problem that they have that you can solve using these techniques. And if you can solve a problem using these techniques, you'll definitely win them over, and they'll be more impressed now and more willing to listen, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love your point about, you know, having that conversation on their terms. And sometimes sharing, if not data, sometimes some people don't respond to data, some people respond to stories. Some people don't do stories, some people do data. I remember joining a company, and I've been at many companies and organizations, and I joined and I was like, it is so difficult here. And I was just kind of joking with my manager. I was like, you realize this is hard. It shouldn't be this hard. And he goes, No, it's fine here. This, you're just onboarding. And I'm like, I don't think. No. And this is where I try to appeal to authority, my authority, right? I'm like, no, I don't think you understand. I'm the expert in the space. This is what I do. I've been many places. This is hard. This is harder than it should be. But this person had been at the company for well over a decade.
Yeah.
And had just kind of gotten used to all of the systems, had all of the shortcuts, all of the back doors, all of the bookmarks, all of the things. And so I kind of had to wait a few months and take a few notes, but then help later come back and help paint this picture and share this story of what it felt like to be a developer and to do software engineering here, and what it felt like and what it meant to be a software engineer at a handful of other companies that looked quite similar, and what could it look like, and was this something that we wanted to explore? And like, if this was definitely a no, then like, that's cool. But I also kind of had to be there for a little bit, not just be all like reactionary, but like my like personal like appeal to authority didn't work. Data didn't work. I totally like came with numbers. I came with no. It needed to be like a very different approach.
Yeah. Yeah. And that resonates with me, that the one of my experiences that was reminding me of, as you were describing it, I worked with a team that was building some complex software, and I was helping them to adopt better software engineering practices. And at one point I was pairing with this guy, and we were refactoring some code, and I said, oh, we could kind of pull that out as a separate class, and we could use that over here, and you know, that would be a really good move. And he just kind of slumped, his body language was all kind of depressed, and I was, what's the matter? And he said, in order to create a new class, I've got to fill in a form and get permission, and I've got to ask somebody else to do all this to create a new class, you know, in C#. I'm going, what? And everybody in that organization thought it was perfectly normal.
So wild.
It's just unbelievable. So it was a process of about 4 days to create a new class.
I love that you brought this up, because I was also just thinking, sometimes you also just need to talk to someone else.
Yeah. My friend Dan North, when we worked together at ThoughtWorks, he came up with a bunch of what he called consultancy patterns. And one of his consultancy patterns was follow the line of most resistance. So you find, we can't do that because, you know, we can't do that. Okay, why can't we do that? Oh, we can't do that because X says we can't do it. Okay, let's go and talk to X. And you just keep doing that until you find the person says, yeah, of course you can do it. But anyway. So let's move on a bit. So more recently, you've been working on space. Another framework for looking at developer productivity. I think we can certainly look at the Dora metrics as that being one of those things too. But so could you describe space for us a little bit?
Sure. So space came about because as I was doing a bunch of my work with Dora and Accelerate, a bunch of companies were bringing me in under the auspices, right? They're like, well, we want to chat with you about Accelerate and improving our software delivery. And we want to chat with you about architecture, CI, CD, kind of removing blockers. Many times very, very technical pieces. Sometimes it was culture, but many times it was very, very technical. And then I would get there and we would spend 30 minutes or an hour on very technical pieces, right? Like what's the best way to improve my architecture here? How can I remove blockers in my CD or my testing? And then we would start shifting into, well, how do I measure the improvement in my systems once I implement this? How do I know if I've made progress? How can I start thinking about measuring the impact of the work that I've done? And I realized that so much of what was happening was people wanting to have a way to measure their work. And so I started just realizing I was also giving people almost the same advice all the time. Come up with at least, you know, first of all, there's no one metric that matters. This is not real. Anytime someone tells you this, like request a refund, get all of your money back. All of this is fake. I'm aware of like a single, like one metric that worked, and they had to go through 5 or 6 years of scientific rigorous testing to make sure that that worked. It's a service quality measure. This is not a thing. It still isn't the best one. So one, there's no one metric that matters. Two is make sure you have at least 2 to 3 metrics that are in tension with each other, right? How can they balance each other out? And then 3 of those 2 to 3 metrics, make sure they are along different dimensions so that you cannot just have 3 different counts of something. And I was like, and then finally, I was like, you know, what I should do is write this down so that instead of repeating this conversation over and over and over again, or copy pasting this email, I can point someone to a paper, which was like kind of a joke, but kind of not. And I realized that so many times people wanted me to help them identify the specific metrics, but many times they could kind of disentangle it themselves, right? Because a lot of times we don't have the perfect data, but we will get to better data, right? So like, I also could just tell people like, these are the 5 things you should measure. DORA metrics are like a little different because we were using survey measures and like they're high enough level, it kind of works. But if you want a specific data point for a company, I need to know what data points you have. So that's where SPACE came from. Now, SPACE is actually a framework that works for almost any type of complex creative work. We wrote it for developer productivity because if I write something too abstract, people are just going to go cross-eyed and they're going to understand it. So I pulled together a handful of friends and we start sketching this out. And there's 5 dimensions. So one is satisfaction, right? Satisfaction and well-being. Are you satisfied in your work, in your tooling? That one's super powerful because if someone absolutely hates a tool, they are probably not going to be productive, right? Is it hard to use? Is it high friction? Do they hate it? You know what? Why would they lie? And also, why would they lie to you about this? They're not going to lie to you about this. I will say lie because it's really hard to get this one without a survey. P is performance. What is the outcome of something? So this could be a quality metric, something like that, something outcome. Mm-hmm. A is activity. Now we are finally talking about counts. Number of pull requests, number of commits, number of something, please, no number of lines of code. C is communication and collaboration. How are people working together? It could be the searchability of your code base. You know, some folks care deeply about, or they're really trying to, you know, do inner sourcing. Could be thinking about coordination costs, right? And then E is efficiency and flow, time through a system. It could be something like flow state. If you reach flow state, it could be handoffs. So number of handoffs is a little weird because it could be number if you think about number of handoffs. But if you think about it in terms of efficiency and flow, if you think about something like SRE, how many hops and routes does it take to get to the right person, right?
Yeah.
So that framework I found helped people think through the general guidelines because then I could say pick from at least 2 or 3 of these categories. So you don't just get, I'm making this up, lines of code, number of PRs, number of commits, never do lines of code, right? Because if you have 3 metrics and they're all under A, no, it doesn't work. You have to cover at least 2 or 3 of these. You don't need all 5. This isn't blackout bingo, right? You don't need to cover all 5. But that way it helps you get a more holistic measure of what's going on. You can see trade-offs that are happening. You're more likely to pick some good measures and some good metrics. And let's say you start with a metric that's like reasonable. It's not the best one, but you can get started. As your data quality and your data availability improves, you can rotate that out and rotate one back in.
Yeah. So I as I was learning about this for myself, I kind of found this interesting. On a number of fronts, this seems very different in some ways. The DORA work, not in a bad way, it's just very different. So the way that I kind of positioned this in the pigeonholes in my head was that this is kind of a sort of meta level framework for metrics. So it's a tool to help you pick your own metrics. It's not doing what Dora does, which is saying, here are four metrics that are, in combination are generic measures of good software development. Doesn't matter of the technology, doesn't matter what you're building, but these are good tools. And the problem in general is that finding those kind of generic metrics is incredibly difficult. I referred to this earlier as, it seems to me genius to come up with that model in the first place. But that's not enough. So knowing that you're being able to release things quickly and that the quality's high doesn't tell me that I'm building the right things. It doesn't tell me that my feature is useful to users. It doesn't tell me it's a nice place to work. That comes as a bit of a side effect, I think. But yeah. There's a lot of other stuff that we need to measure as well. And what
so I think there's another way to think about this as well.
Okay.
And part of this will come with me being a little snarky and a little more thoughtful. So one is a lot of people just get Dora wrong. And part of this is probably my fault, right? Dora is more than just the Dora 4 metrics, right? Those metrics were interesting from a industry benchmarking point of view, right?
Yeah.
We discovered some really interesting patterns, and those patterns are that speed and stability always move together. They tend to cluster bucket very, very reliably year over year over year over year, right? They just do, which is really interesting because you don't tend to see this in cluster analysis. Yeah. So by that, it means that we see them break out so that the two speed, the two stability, reliability metrics, they always kind of bucket together, and we see these breakouts. So you have your used to be elite, but your high, medium, your low performers. We see this kind of stratification.
Yeah.
People really latched onto that. So they think that Dora was just these four metrics. Sometimes I joke like there's a whole book.
Yeah.
So by that, I mean, let's say you've got your four metrics, you know how well you're performing. I like to say that's signal, and then there's action. You get quick signal. How well am I doing? Quick. Yeah. And how well did it do compared to last time I checked? Am I trending up? Am I trending down? Am I improving? Yeah. Am I regressing? But some people are like, well, I just don't like Dora because it labels me and then I feel bad. Sorry. But also, what am I going to do with it? That's where the rest of the research program comes in. Yeah. We have, we've talked about this. There's CI, CD, architectural practices, cultural practices, lean management practices, all of these other things. And that's where the rest of the research program has general guidelines right on CI. There were a couple technical pieces. There was a behavioral piece that can point you to how to improve. Can give you rough guidelines, right? If you're doing CI right, you got to do these three things. If you're doing version control right, you got to be doing these a couple things. If you're doing automated testing right, you got to be doing these five or six things.
Yeah.
And so you can kind of work backward to say, to improve my Dora metrics, I've got 40 things to choose from.
Yeah.
And you can kind of just look at it. There are several ways you could do value stream mapping. You could do constraints and algorithmic based constraints analysis. You can just say, what do people swear at all the time? Now, this is where space helps come in, because we've got our Dora 4, but then you say, now I want to improve these. How do I know if they are improving? How do I track that improvement over time? If I decide to make an investment in my automated testing, as an example, if I decide to make an investment in my adoption of cloud compute, and that's not just giving Azure or AWS or GCP more money, that's shifting over to the appropriate architectural practices, right? You can look at those five pieces, but then how do I operationalize them, right? How do I turn this into a set of metrics that can show up in a dashboard or show up in a report, or I can track week over week or month over month? Because now you're not going to send out a survey every week because everyone's just going to block your email, right? Yeah. Now we can't do surveys. We can do surveys maybe quarterly, maybe. So now, this is where you come to space and you could say, okay, for automated testing, what do I want to do? Satisfaction, right? Are we willing to ask people maybe a couple times a year if they're satisfied with the automated tooling? Performance, what are the outcomes of my automated tests? Are they reliable? Do I have flaky tests? Do they have to be rerun? How many escape defects do I have? Activity, how many tests are running? how many tests have to be rerun? C, communication and collaboration. We could skip it, or you could look and see if like people have to ping each other to run tests or find tests or something. Efficiency and flow. How long does it take to run tests?
Yeah.
How often are they being included? How often are they, or like, are they being skipped? Are they being included? That might be activity. That might be flow, right? Are they being included in the flow every time? How long does it take? Are there delays included? So that kind of captures your automated tech, a more holistic measure of your automated tests instead of, are we using them or not?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We could also include some cultural pieces in some of the communication part, which is, are people maintaining our automated test suites? Because if they're not being maintained, then flaky tests aren't really going to be improved. Then the overall test runtime won't really be improved, because I'll just keep creating bad or leave bad automated tests in there. I won't have a good culture of maintaining and improving my test suites.
Yeah, yeah.
And throw them out there for a month, and if a couple don't work, then like pull a couple out, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. I think I would describe that slightly differently, but I would agree 100%. So you know, I think that what we're talking about is that the problem with the so what I was trying to contrast with the Dora metrics and using space as a framework is that the Dora metrics are kind of generic, and that's really handy, but they don't tell us enough, and everything else everything else that we've thought of so far pretty much is contextual. It's about those. So the way that I would describe that is working experimentally. We need to select what our measures are and decide what our experiment is. You spoke about, you know, having a hypothesis at the start. I have a hypothesis that improving my automated testing is going to improve maybe my Dora metrics. So how do I measure, or I have a hypothesis that improving my automated testing is a good thing. So how would I tell? How would I decide that was the case?
Right.
What things do I need to measure to achieve that? And space gives us a tool that helps us choose some measures that it doesn't tell us the answer, but it gives us a route to find the answer, which is an interesting.
And it's nice because it's relatively quick, right? Like we just ran through that kind of off the top of my head in what, 1 or 2 minutes? Because many times we'll default to things that we're used to seeing, or we have an availability bias. What's the data that we have available we're used to looking at, which might have just been test runs of flaky tests or something. But by even just looking at the framework really quickly and just running through and checking off each one and saying, like, you know, we went through C and I was like, maybe not applicable here. Maybe it's just not great. Or maybe we just don't have data. That's fine. But I've covered at least 3 or 4 others. Now let me go look. I can time box it to an hour or two, and I could say, what data do I have available? Let me make sure I'm covering at least a few of these dimensions.
Yeah. And if not,
and
figure
not
out what more data
on
to
number
collect.
Of runs.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the old joke about the drunk looking for something underneath the street light, you know, because that's where the light is. But you know, and we do way too much of that kind of thing, I think, in software. That focus on working experimentally, I think, is pretty pervasive in terms, to me at least, in terms of my thinking about how to move in the direction of a strong engineering stance rather than just, you know, software development as a craft or something. You know, if we want to be doing engineering, then we should be treating things as little experiments. You know, try stuff out and figure out how we're going to measure it, control the variables so that we can understand the results as far as we can, and then carry out the experiment and try and poke holes in it.
Especially for the parts of engineering that are, and maybe this is going to be controversial, I think there are parts of development that are very much craft, and I think there are parts of engineering that are very much maybe engineering. And by that I mean there are aspects of being a developer where you really lean into craft and innovation and creativity. And a lot of that comes when we are interacting with the IDE, right? We are problem solving. We are even debugging, right? We're writing new code and new features, and we're getting in the flow, and we're doing all of this work. Now, what you're talking about, the engineering aspect of it, I think there's so much of the SDLC that we can just engineer the heck out of. And that helps us do our craft better. Because if we can reduce variability, improve predictability, make our test suites super reliable, super predictable, super fast, get our build and our integration and our outer loop set, then when I've pushed code, then I know it's done. It's not coming back to me. I'm not going to get interrupted. All of the signals that I get, I can rely on, right? There's nothing worse. Like, it just really sucks to get interrupted by something that I've already pushed and code gets kicked back to me because something downstream, somebody else's code caused a failure and then I have to deal with something. Yeah. Or a build somewhere else, right? I thought I passed all of my tests and all my builds and then something gets flagged later and it comes back to me. Like, why? Why? No. No. I don't want that, right? So, and I think that the two go hand in hand, right? Let me be in this wonderful loop of creating, exploring, and fast feedback so I can do this learning. But then the pieces that I want to engineer the heck out of, let me engineer the heck out of it.
I think we might have a slightly different take on what we mean by engineering based on that answer. That's interesting. So I think often when we talk about engineering in software, we often, forgive me being arguing with you.
No, please.
But I think that often we think of engineering in terms of production things, production lines, you know, fixed, rigid outcomes. And I don't think that's what engineering is about. I think the example that always goes through my head when I think of engineering is, you know, the people designing and building the Curiosity rover. They had no clue what the answer was. They were trying stuff out. I think that engineering is probably at the peak of human creativity. So I think, and you know, that's our form of engineering. So I don't think, you know, engineering is the non-creative part and craft is the creative part. And I'm not sure that you were saying exactly that. But I think that we can, you know, we can have guide rails that constrain our creativity and help us to get to better outcomes, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think when we are creating, then that part is absolutely craft. I think it's frustrating when the guardrails and the way that we get our code where it should be going stops us and creates friction and creates blockers. That's frustrating. And I love that you called that out, right? Because there are infrastructure engineers where their craft is creating that infrastructure, right? Like that's what they're doing. And like that's their jam, and God bless them. And that's where I do like a whole bunch of my work, right? Is in a lot of this, like pull requests out, like all through Outer Loop, through release engineering. Like that's the hard, interesting, like challenging work. And also, what are the ways that we can make this kind of like this delightful experience so that, I guess another way to think about it is, it feels really frustrating. And I continue to hear from engineers because I'm only a like sloppy hacker at this point. It's really frustrating when you're writing code and you're kind of done, like you've done like the what your real work, what your primary work is. And then you've got to go write up a whole bunch of code to like get it through the rest of the infrastructure process. Mm-hmm. When it doesn't feel like, when that feels like toil.
Yeah. So, you know, if I want to be creative, I definitely want fast feedback and to be making progress in small steps and all of those things. That's how we grow things. We evolve, you know, complicated things, seems to me. I've just looked at the time and I realized that we got carried away with our conversation and gone a little over time.
We've had the best chat.
so let me just wrap up for the viewers and listeners. Thank you very much indeed to Nicole, first of all, for taking part in this fascinating conversation. I certainly learned a lot and enjoyed it a lot. So thank you, Nicole.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.